Georgi Tinkov, Ray Pete, we were just talking about redundancy, prepping, and being prepared for a future where they kick you out of the financial system, tell you you can't go to the grocery store, and what else, Ray? What else will we not allowed to not be allowed to do in the future?
Basically, anything that spends money.
And then, we're talking about prepping for like a momentary thing. But if you're kicked out of the financial system for life, there's gonna have to be a rise new kind of alternative ways of exchange, correct?
A lot of people are getting silver, gold doesn't work too well for daily exchanges because you'd have to chop it up into such tiny pieces. But silver is convenient as a practical currency.
Excuse my ignorance, but how would that even work? Like, would the person know, like, how much, like, an ounce of or a tiny amount of gold would be, like, valued at in exchange?
With gold, it involves a certain amount of trust that the person doesn't have some strange alloy that he's pawning off. But silver is very practical in the sense that you can carry enough in your pocket to feed yourself for quite a few days, and it's identifiable as silver rather than other things.
And then isn't in Klaus's book, I have not read the book, unfortunately, but I think he says people will live outside the smart cities and things like that. So that alternative economy, I mean, even the people pulling these heists are recognizing that is going to be a thing.
What isn't going to be?
That not everybody is going to live in the smart cities with the identifications and things like that.
Probably 70 or 80% of the people will just do whatever the government tells them to. But if 10 or 20% of the people set up an outside economy, it'll work.
And then Georgie interrupted at any moment here. And then, this is the last show of the year, you know, what, without getting too like maybe an elevator pitch, like what is there anything that sticks out in your mind is like phenomenally important or too many things that stick out in your mind? Like, what are your thoughts on 2021?
About this past year?
Yeah. Just everything that happened. Just horrifying in general.
And the solutions are being hidden from all ends of the political spectrum. Everyone is being taught that the other end of the spectrum is out to get them, and it's really only the 0.01%, which is out to get everyone else. The people that Hillary and Obama called the deplorables, they are just as much ready for an actual solution and radical change as the people who think of themselves as the vanguard and most progressive.
When I was picking up a bunch of packages, there was an art studio next to that. And the woman kind of told me to come in the art studio and we got to talking. And then her husband came and we inevitably started talking about COVID. And both of them in Mexico had three vaccines. And one was from England and the other one was from Israel. And then the husband and I started talking because he reads research. And when we were talking, he had to put me in a partisan box. Like he couldn't, he had to label me as like a Trump supporter to entertain anything I was saying, even though I was telling him that I haven't voted since Bush Kerry, but like he was like unable to entertain any idea outside of partisan politics, but he was English. He wasn't even American. It was very odd.
What nationality?
He was from London and his wife was from Israel.
The English are more obedient than Americans.
And then the thing I've been running into anytime I talk to a normal person about this is that coronavirus is so dangerous that anything is worth, however tyrannical the implementation is, it's worth it because coronavirus is the most dangerous thing we've ever experienced in our lifetime.
Yeah, that really is. People should just start looking at some of the facts. Have you heard any of Norman Fenton's?
No.
Talks about these statistics. He's a professor at Queen's University in London, statistical practical questions, and he, all of his papers used to be published until he decided to look at the actual figures for mortality and what the virus is doing. And anytime you look at the actual deaths from the so-called pandemic, what they did was simply rename influenza and several other major causes of seasonal death, simply renamed them COVID, and it had to miraculous effect of ending death from influenza around the world for a couple of years. But essentially, just looking at those, the one or two weeks figures for when there's a gigantic surge in deaths from COVID, there's a gigantic disappearance of deaths from influenza. Just looking at that one fact coming out of the CDC and other government agencies, the only thing you conclude is that there is never was a COVID pandemic. People have had coronavirus colds for hundreds of years, and that's all it is. It's a renaming any respiratory-related sickness and even all sorts of other things as COVID just to create panic.
So I'm starting to question even the influenza. How did they know before in the past when we had the 60 to 80,000 deaths in the United States from the flu? How did they know these were from the flu? They didn't test them with the PCR test.
Just a few years ago, people asked that question, and the CDC said, well, it might not have really been 60,000 deaths this year, but it was at least 1,200 caused by the influenza virus.
Well, how about we call them iatrogenic deaths? Because one thing is certain, these people died in the hospitals, right?
Yeah.
Are they still?
So maybe that's all it is. Every year we have at least 60 to 80,000 people dying in the hospital, showing up with respiratory symptoms, but ultimately they died in the care of the of these doctors. I mean, I don't know of many people who died from the flu at home.
And once you see the terrible emptiness of the government figures regarding coronavirus, that might make you wonder, what about the other vaccines? Did the polio vaccine really cure polio, or did suddenly polio disappear to be replaced by almost identical numbers of Guillain-Barré paralysis and other paralytic diseases? The vaccine cured the named paralysis, but didn't cure the incidence of paralytic disease.
Do you think this Guillain-Barré syndrome has its origin in the gastrointestinal tract, some kind of inflammatory reaction there?
Yeah. The polio virus and all of the related things are essentially a gastrointestinal. Way back in the 1920s or 30s, a gastroenterologist was experimenting with a distemper in dogs, and he could give them an infection and then cut them open and see what was happening. In the early stages of the distemper sickness, where they had classified it as a respiratory disease, all that was happening was virus infection of the intestine. And refluxes from the intestine were causing the respiratory symptoms, but the respiratory tissues were absolutely free of virus at the peak of the disease. It was all intestinal infection causing reflex inflammation of the lungs and respiratory system. And that seems to be how a lot of the viruses work. They first make your intestine permeable to bacteria and toxins, and then it's the sepsis that triggers the inflammatory cytokine storm sort of thing.
So this reflux pneumonia, which they prepare for during surgery, they give people anti-acid drugs. So basically, like, we're seeing that in all of the you're saying we're seeing this in the other paralytic conditions. It can happen even without surgery.
Can happen without.
So when people lie on the operating table, they usually, before that, they give them these strong anti-acid drugs because they're afraid that they're going to reflux and it's going to get into their lungs and cause pneumonia. But you're saying that we can have this even without the surgery.
There have been some very clear studies in which people who recover slowly from surgery or who die following complications after surgery, what's happening is that the stress of the surgery made their intestine permeable to the toxins that are not being suppressed by active digestion. And if they clean their intestine for 2 or 3 days thoroughly with antibiotics before going into surgery, just about 100% of them had no surgical stress complications following the cutting.
So I guess it will be a good regimen if somebody's about to have surgery, even if it's not abdominal, if it's going to be a long-time surgery, just sterilize the intestine anyways.
Even if the doctors aren't, if they don't read the literature, the person should take laxatives and have make sure their hormones are good, have a very fibrous diet for several days before surgery, get a clean flow going through.
Speaking of fiber, I actually wanted to talk about oat bran. And so a long time ago, you know, somebody asked you, like, what were the safest grains? And I think you said Mazzarella, oats, and maybe one other thing I can't remember. But is you using oat bran, is that more of an intestinal disinfectant, or is it a source of carbohydrate for you?
The oat bran, I read that a cup of the cooked stuff, it's fairly filling, So a cup is a big serving, but it has only 88 calories, where regular oatmeal has maybe 250 or so for the same thing. So it does provide some carbohydrate, but it's strongly buffered by the presence of a higher fiber content. And studies in animals showed that over a long run, you might have to worry about some of the breakdown products of the soluble fibers that can have an estrogenic effect. But in the short run, up to a year or so, its effect is a matter of the bulk and acceleration of the intestine. So it has an anti estrogen effect for people who have been reabsorbing the estrogen that their liver tries to excrete.
So if would you still use the carrot when you had a oat bran in the morning or something?
And for someone, occasionally someone has an oversensitive intestine, and the carrot is too powerfully stimulating and can cause a headache or diarrhea or other intestinal reactions. So the oat bran is milder. Mushrooms are sort of in between. It depends on how you, if you grind them or chop them fairly fine, they are an effective but fairly mild fiber. Bamboo shoots are very, very high fiber content, so a little of it has a strong effect in helping to clean up your intestine.
I will say oat bran as a breakfast, I really don't know much better than that. It's so easy to make. It takes like a minute, and even like a fourth a cup seems really filling. So it's like...
yeah, and if you put the right amount of butter and salt in it when you're cooking, it's really extremely pleasant.
With milk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, milk, milk, butter, and... sugar. And then, but you did mention, of course, and the whole internet knows this, but it contains phytic acid. So you'd want to have more calcium, or if you made it with milk, do you think that would balance it out?
Some studies say that, it just about negates the value of the milk you have with it. So you probably have to eat extra milk more than you would think. And, but 2 quarts of milk will take care of just about anything.
And then I think even a fourth a cup might have had like 500 milligrams of phosphorus in it. So that is just adding to kind of the daily phosphorus intake.
Yeah. So you really need a lot of milk to balance it.
Great stuff. And Georgie, interrupt me at any point in time. But, you know, I just moved into a new place and I've been scanning my environment for things that might be inflammatory or toxic. And so I have some, and I emailed you about a bed, you know, because I fingers crossed I'm here for a long time. But like, just open question to you, if you were to move into a house with all the new technologies and things, what do you think would be the first things that you would deem as a huge problem and try to mitigate?
If it has computer stuff, I would get wire, they call it Ethernet, a cable connections between all of the parts instead of Wi-Fi.
And what about grounding equipment? And so I've been spending lots of time with speaker wire and taking the prongs out of plugs and wrapping them around and plugging them into grounds. Do you think, so I have like a bunch of equipment on the desk right now. Should I try, or should a person try to ground everything metal in their environment?
Check it if you have a field meter. Mm-hmm. Check whether your monitor is putting out a big field. My Macintosh monitor had a huge field and was very hot, so I just bought a different monitor, and I have a grounding pad, but it didn't affect the Macintosh monitor enough to bother with.
What's the more effective strategy, grounding every item and yourself, or is it more important to be for yourself to be grounded, or what?
Only if it has a big field, you're sure is reaching out. Mm-hmm. 2 or 3 feet beyond the monitor or your keyboard. Mm-hmm. But when you have things connected by the wires, your general environment is much reduced.
And then similar question, you mentioned maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago about grounding a person's bed. Can you maybe explain that a little bit more if you think that's something important?
Going barefoot in Mexico, the temperature is good enough that you can walk barefoot outside anytime you feel like it. Even in town, people are going to look at you if you walk barefooted down the sidewalk, but there's no law against it. The daytime contact with the earth, I think is enough to get you through the night without grounding. But you can get sheets and bedding that have copper wires woven into the fabric and a connection to put a wire to ground. Theoretically, that protects you considerably from the, if you have a 60 cycle or 50 cycle electricity in your environment.
And what's like the bioenergetic perspective of being grounded? Like what exactly does that even do?
They talk about it as a, this is a sort of a buffer to the electrons that are being produced metabolically. And if you take a piece of skin, people vary according to their metabolic rate and thyroid function, but you can put a piece of skin in a culture dish, and it will keep projecting a static field into the surrounding space. If you put cyanide in the culture dish, stopping respiration, the electrical field collapses, and washing the cyanide out, the field comes back. And so people are, in effect, bristling with their own, it's like a static field. An electret is what you call it when it's established in wax or plastic. For a long time, they had electret needles for phonograph pickups. Instead of electromagnetic, it was a piece of ceramic or plastic that had a static electrical field implanted in the plastic or ceramic as it was hardening. And that polarized system of electrons projects the field permanently so that you, if you vibrate that piece of plastic, it creates an electrical current. So it's just a variation on electromagnetic pickups. But it's a very powerful phenomenon that if you're handling plastic bottles, for example, sometimes it will mess up the ability to control the fluid that you want to get out of the bottle because the plastic has such a strong electrical field built into it. We are being a soft, flexible material. We have to generate that structure and field momentarily by respiring. In an isolated environment, that could lead to influences backwards from our environment to our metabolism. Supposedly, if you ground yourself, that keeps the extraneous charges from interfering with your own biological generation of that electret-like static field.
Very interesting.
So instead of grounding yourself, wouldn't taking, a hefty dosage of quinones like methylene blue or vitamin K would have a similar effect?
That keeps you oxidizing. That's protective internally, but the grounding people emphasize that it's protective, at least in some circumstances, to make sure you aren't being surrounded by the wrong kind of electrical charge.
Oh, this is from like if you're submerged in a static field because of electric devices or things like that. That's what the grounding protects from.
Yeah,
that was my next question because I forgot what the experiment was, but somebody on YouTube showed that when they were grounded, I can't remember how they did this, but they showed that the EMF was less intense or something. That and that made me more interested in it after hearing that.
I repeated those experiments, and you can see the change. Your body. When I was doing electrical stimulation experiments, I tried to set up things to detect the internal electrical behavior of tissues and organisms, but I found that putting a strong detector on my animal or my tissue or myself, we got the rock music radio station, no matter what tissue we were trying to examine, the radio station was so powerful, it was swamping all of the intrinsic biological signals.
That's like a low-level EMF device that you were using, right?
Yeah,
so it's probably way worse now.
Before I ever supplemented thyroid, I think it was 1976 that I first decided to go ahead with my intuition, because before that, I knew that I had the hypothyroid signs, the classical things, except that my metabolic rate was very high. Just at rest, I was burning about 4,000 calories, and in a BMR test, I was 200 or 300% above normal oxygen consumption, and that delayed me for several years from believing that I could be hypothyroid. But anyway, when I took thyroid, suddenly my metabolic energy went down towards normal. But in the few years before I took thyroid, being around lab instruments of various sorts, I was able to see that high internal metabolism was causing me to have extremely exaggerated projection of charge fields around me, so that in lab, where we had to use an electronic stimulator to produce a certain voltage to stimulate cells, if I reached towards it, got within a foot of it to adjust a knob, the machine would just suddenly run off scale and go full force. And as I pulled my hand away, it would go back, sort of like the theremin music instrument that you adjust the pitch according to your position of your hand. But I had to always have my lab partner operate the machine because my hand made it malfunction. And anything electrical tended to be disturbed. Even a cosmic ray cloud chamber, the ionization behavior of the humid atmosphere was cleared up by this field that extended about a foot to a foot and a half beyond my body.
So the people who basically tend to get shocked very often for no apparent reason, is it fair to say that they have very high rate of metabolism, but the electrons are not getting paired properly with oxygen, so they build up and they sort of create this field?
Yeah, I think so.
When you are taking thyroid, what happened? I mean, I guess it lowered your stress hormones, so your metabolic rate went down?
I've seen it in three or four other men about the same age in their 30s, usually, who, no matter how much they ate, couldn't put on weight. They would often be 120 or 30 pounds for a standard height. But if they took thyroid, suddenly their ability to build muscle and fat with a normal amount of food was restored. When you're hypothyroid, I think the mechanism is that your cells lose the ability to constantly retain magnesium. So if the cells lose magnesium chronically, they run their energy apparatus the magnesium allows the ATP to accumulate. And if you can't accumulate the ATP, you have to make it constantly. And the thyroid supplement, I think, is letting you retain the necessary magnesium to stabilize the ATP so you can turn off the production periodically.
So these people are basically have upregulated glycolysis to produce the necessary ATP through the less efficient means if thyroid is not available.
And that's where the symptoms and deterioration come in. So it's very wasteful of food to have that happen, but it keeps things working very nicely.
But what about the people who put on weight too easily? What's the explanation there? Again, in terms of low thyroid, or
just low thyroid is not running the machine fast enough.
Who do you say is in a worse position? A person who puts on weight easily, or cannot put on weight no matter how much they eat?
The people I've known, like myself, were very energetic and healthy. But they just couldn't put on weight no matter how much they ate.
Okay, but this is still stress metabolism, right? Because thyroid wasn't functioning properly.
It was as long as it was able to use the energy and make ATP, it didn't have to resort to other sources to make ATP. In those hypermetabolic states, there's not necessarily any glycolysis going on.
And what was keeping your metabolic rate so high if thyroid wasn't optimal?
I think a diet that was heavy on phosphate, not enough calcium and magnesium. People who have experimented with allergy patients found that the active thyroid hormone let you retain magnesium if you were given it, but without the T3, you could put the magnesium in and they would work perfectly for a few days and then they would lose the magnesium. Taking a supplement of magnesium can temporarily moderate your metabolism, so you don't have that hyper metabolic reaction to low thyroid.
But you have to keep taking it over and over because you lose it quickly without the ATP.
The doctors experimenting on their patients found that one or two intravenous doses was enough to work for a week, but then they could take it orally keep their magnesium up and their allergies down.
And maybe you mentioned a few years ago with good thyroid function, you could even get, I don't know, what was it, like 200 milligrams of magnesium that would be sufficient? Like some people on the internet take like 1,000 or 2,000 milligrams every day?
The body, when it's efficient, can suck up and retain a fairly modest amount from your food supply. But if your thyroid is low, then you have to worry about the constant supply of generous magnesium.
So in keeping, thanks for that, in keeping with our non-toxic, anti-inflammatory home, Probably, I don't know, was it 2018? I emailed you about a home air purifier, and you told me you had the Mystic Marvels device, and so I immediately bought that and experimented with it. And so that's, what is a negative ion generator, and why is it useful?
The majority of the careful studies found that the serotonin disposition is increased immediately by negative ions in the air in particular, because the lungs are the main, the liver does it, but the lungs have the first access to the circulating platelets carrying serotonin produced by stress and irritation, inflammation. So if your lungs need a boost of energy to detoxify that circulating stress-related serotonin, the electrons delivered on air ions participate directly in the monoamino oxidase reaction to eliminate it. And some of the studies show that the blood level of serotonin is decreased as you have more ionized negative air.
So just having that around you, especially in the evening time, like maybe next to your bed, would be a good way to not go extremely hypometabolic during the nighttime?
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay.
I think very high altitude, the ultraviolet in the air is intense enough to give you a steady supply of negative ions.
Oh, interesting.
Why do you think some people email me studies showing that there's an increased risk of suicide at altitude? What do you think is responsible for that, if it's even legit?
I looked at many of the countries around the world, and that simply is a bad generalization. It probably has to do with social economic conditions in Colorado, which they were looking at. But when you look at Bangladesh and Tibet and Colombia and the low-lying Latin cultures, there's absolutely no correlation.
In fact, the people living in the field have a much higher rate, right?
Generally the health is worse as your altitude is lower. Every 1,000 feet of altitude where you live decreases heart disease mortality, cancer mortality, and dementia.
You mentioned in some of your books about the extreme longevity in places like Azerbaijan and like the Caucasus Mountains. There's this guy, I think his last name is Muslimov. He lived in the former Soviet Union. He was an Azeri guy who had a passport showing that he was 160 some years old when he actually died. The altitude there is high, but it's not that high. He lived at an altitude of about 1,800 meters. Do you think there's studies that have you seen studies that show that even higher altitude, like in the Himalayas, for example, the Sherpas that live there at much higher altitude, are they living on average longer?
All the figures I've seen show that cancer and heart disease are consistently lower the higher you live. And osteoporosis is something very directly connected. Your bones get stronger and teeth stay in longer.
So the altitude, I guess, is half of it, and the other half is diet, because that guy who lived to 168 ate mostly milk and a little bit of bread.
That area, the dairy area, they get plenty of milk and cheese.
Yeah,
he got married at the age of 140 and had children, apparently.
Azerbaijan is, you've mentioned them frequently, right? They have, like, kind of the foods you recommend, isn't that right? Like, historically?
Yeah, I've seen pictures of their meals. They look very delicious.
Did you go there when you visited the Soviet Union?
Nope.
Amazing. Okay, we'll give Ray a break here. Let me do a little advertisement. So the newsletter is available by email now. It's $28, which can be paid through PayPal to raypeetsnewsletter@gmail.com. And Ray, if I heard you correctly, you switched to how many times a month? Four? I mean, I'm sorry, how many times a year? Four times?
Four times a year, more or less quarterly. Instead of a two-year subscription with 12 issues total, it's now 3 years for $30 or 1 year for $10 for four issues.
I should adjust this. That's amazing. I don't know how you kept up with the 2 month schedule. I think I would have quit doing that after maybe, I don't know, a month or two. Like, that would have been really amazing.
Yeah, for the first 20 years, I was doing it every month. Oh my God. Then the next 20, 21 years, I did it every other month. But part of the thing was that a bi-monthly subscription, people were confused and thought their subscription was for 1 year because it was 12 issues or didn't know what bi-monthly meant. And so they were constantly causing email questioning that took too much time.
I just lost it. It was $30 for 3 years? What was it?
$10 per year.
Okay.
So for the 12 issues, that used to be $28. Now it comes to $30.
Okay, got it. Okay, and then also you can get your amazing books, Gender of Energy, From PMS to Menopause, Mind and Tissue, and Nutrition for Women by emailing raypeetsnewsletter@gmail.com. And you can get them in digital, and some of them are available in paperback, correct?
Several are still available.
And then Progest E from Kenogen, you can email Catherine to purchase Kenogen@gmail.com. And each bottle of Progest E contains 3,400 milligrams of progesterone. I just purchased 30 bottles. So thank you, Ray. Please tell Catherine I said thank you. And then my plan is to mix that with, I purchased a lot of DHE from Bulk, I think it was bulkpowder.com, and I'll mix those together. But Ray, any recent progesterone stories that you have?
Nope.
Did we talk about cycling the last time you were on, how imperative that was for even somebody?
For women, it's very important to the extent that their estrogen is still a problem, because even small amounts of estrogen, if it's continuous and not interrupted, are carcinogenic eventually. And so the cycling function of progesterone is to thoroughly knock out the estrogen influence and let the tissue gather itself together. It completely stops the estrogen cycle, carcinogenic cycle, if you interrupt it properly. But when you take progesterone steadily without interruption, your liver interprets the constant high level of progesterone as being excessive. And so the anything your liver experiences at a high level, it produces enzymes to excrete. And so after 2 weeks, your liver has built up excretory enzymes that inactivate the progesterone. After 2 weeks, the effect of a given dose of progesterone is weaker, and stopping for at least a week lets your liver reset its threshold for excreting progesterone, so you get more for your money.
A couple of questions here. First of all, if progesterone being a catatoxic steroid, it increases the amount of cytochrome P450, the amount that is synthesized. Isn't that in general a very good thing, because you're going to be able to detox quite a few other substances, even though that will also detox the progesterone faster?
Yeah. It does have that general cleaning up effect.
Okay. And then as far as the actual acceleration of the detox, wouldn't it be less of a problem if the person took it topically? Because it will avoid the first pass metabolism, it will be the liver will have to deal with smaller amounts per unit of time, so it wouldn't upregulate it as much.
It doesn't get it on the first pass anyway. That happens with some drugs, but progesterone in vitamin E being perfectly soluble in the chylomicrons. Bypasses the liver many passes until it is all distributed into your fat tissue, your brain, and everywhere that takes it up. But the chylomicrons are privileged to pass through the liver without giving up their progesterone. So there's no first pass effect when you take progesterone in vitamin E.
And when you told the pharmaceutical rep that, he was not very happy to hear that? Because you're explaining your patent, right? That the pharmaceutical rep came to your house and he was talking about purchasing it, maybe?
That was DHEA, actually. I told him examples of how it worked for 3 hours or so all afternoon. And he said, "That's all very interesting, but that's not a good drug."
I didn't know this. You had what? The DHA was dissolved in the vitamin E, and that's something you had. I thought they were always mixed together. You were giving me.
No, it was a second patent two years later.
Oh, interesting.
I think it's a testosterone, DHA, and progesterone and pregnenolone, right?
No, just they were separate. DHEA was a separate patent.
Oh, because I think I saw something about testosterone in vitamin E from you.
I used to distribute that especially for arthritis in either men or women, and I wanted it so I didn't have to mix it special for each one. So I put a functional amount of all of them, so that it wouldn't be far out of balance for either men or women. And applying it topically or orally, it was extremely effective for knocking out arthritis.
Was testosterone not a controlled substance back in the day? I mean, did FDA clamp down, really regulating it recently?
They got worse and worse.
Wow.
Speaking of vitamin E, I've been meaning to ask you this for like 10 episodes now, but what is the vitamin K and vitamin E bad redox event that happens when you take them together?
If they're pure, I had the various analogs, vitamin K itself and things I extracted from liver and various quinones, and putting them together, they formed a blackish green, apparently an oxidation process, but putting that dark blackish green oil onto a paper chromatograph as the solvent moved up the paper, it separated them back into the normal vitamin K and vitamin E colors. Showing that it was only a charge transfer, but in the body, if you have a charge transfer circulating in your blood, that becomes extremely sensitive to environmental light effects.
So if a person's going to take vitamin K or vitamin E, they should take them away from each other, right?
Somewhat.
Or not get exposed to bright sunlight or light for the next few hours.
Yeah.
Is riboflavin also subject to the same restriction, vitamin B2?
It's anything. Blue light or ultraviolet will destroy riboflavin and cause mutations and inflammation in your tissues where it happens. So if you take a lot of riboflavin, you want to stay out of the sun for a while.
Have you seen the patents Pfizer filed on, they call it photodynamic therapy with methylene blue and red light?
Yeah, but that's to kill viruses, basically.
They also claim, I mean, they patented specifically for cancer. They're saying instead of giving you toxic drugs that increase reactive oxygen species, we're just going to give you methylene blue and then irradiate you, and they will achieve the same reactive oxygen species generation, which I think is dangerous, right?
It's the same as most chemotherapies. They hope it's more specific to the cancer than to your brain cells, but it always kills a lot of your brain cells.
If someone were in this day and age, especially the COVID, if they're really afraid of the virus and they think they have it, would like a controlled version of this, let's say just a few milligrams of methylene blue and some red light, would that be a good therapy, antiviral therapy?
Only good in the sense that it's less toxic than some other things. But I wouldn't recommend it.
What about for things like disinfecting water? Put some methylene blue and then irradiate with red light. Would that work?
Probably would leave some residues in the water that would be unpredictable.
Okay.
Last thing about the negative ion generator, because that dude, the Mystic Marvels guy, he doesn't sell them anymore. And so a buddy of mine sent him an email and he recommended the WEIN Wine V2500 high density ionic air purifier. Do you have any opinion on that? Have you ever heard of it before?
No, but I would trust that guy to know what he's talking about.
Yeah. So
he stopped making it. He said it was just too much work.
Didn't he also say people were buying them near the coast and that was breaking them? And so he'd make it and then they'd break and then they'd want to return them or something. But yeah, so this is the one he recommended for anybody that's interested. And then, again, we're really hopping around here. But a lot of people are, and myself included, are confused about the variants. And so I remember the thing I remember that David E. Martin said was the variants, you could like take the sequence of the or coronavirus and just cut it off at different places and boom, you have a new variant. What is actually going on here? It's like, obviously they're not just like perfectly.
Yeah, the CDC just recently told the FDA that it could discontinue the use of PCR because it's meaningless. But the people who've been promoting it either were completely ignorant about what a PCR is. In fact, a lot of supposedly competent people were when you use it to identify RNA, such as coronavirus, you have to make DNA from the RNA before you can run the PCR on using the DNA replicase or polymerase. So the full name for the method is reverse transcriptase hyphen polymerase chain reaction. For some reason, some people were calling it real-time PCR. They thought it sounded like it was more effective or something, neglecting that the RT refers to reverse transcriptase, which is an essential part of the process. Almost no one advocating the test has any idea what goes on in multiplying the DNA that you make from the RNA. It's a manufacturing process that depends on the particular little stretch of DNA that you choose to amplify. You choose a stretch of the DNA out of whatever RNA you might have started with. And so you have to trust that the RNA sample was actually meaningfully connected to the virus, not to say anything about connected to the disease, but connected to the virus, and then that you chose a sequence to multiply, and that in the process of increasing the amount of RNA of that particular bit of specimen, that you were actually replicating that DNA and not some random background material. But they generally ran it 40 cycles where everyone recognized that beyond 25 cycles, you were getting so many false positives, it was meaningless. So there's nothing about the PCR test that has been used honestly, and it has very consistently been used fraudulently, deliberately, by the government agencies and a lot of their apologists.
But they, I mean, obviously Omicron and Delta, these are just media marketing campaigns. Like these have, they can just create an endless amount of variants and then put them through the channels of marketing, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, at what point a mutation creates a totally new, what should I call it, family of viruses? Can the coronavirus mutate to the point where it becomes a completely different type, like species of a virus? It's no longer a coronavirus, but let's say a rhinovirus or any other RNA virus?
Very unlikely, even under lab circumstances, it's hardly possible. So many radical changes have to be done.
So wouldn't this mutation game eventually sort of like get exhausted? Isn't that why we're starting to see this? They're starting to hype up the avian viruses, the swine flu again is propping up. They're running out of options.
The normal evolution of the virus is to get weaker and weaker and weaker. So it has a better chance of surviving if it doesn't kill its host prematurely. To the extent that there is some knowledge about the Omicron version, it's very harmless, like a mild cold.
I heard you could get a myocarditis from the Omicron variant. Is that true?
Yeah, you can get it from any virus.
Well, everything that they accuse the coronavirus of causing from these long COVID, like heart damage, lung damage, etc. If you Google that with influenza, you'll get at least 10 studies saying that flu can cause it as well.
Yeah, I think long COVID is as questionable as short COVID.
Well, one last thing, and then we can go into questions. But medical nemesis Ivan Illich, he says modern medicine is a negation of health. It isn't organized to serve human health, but only itself as an institution. It makes more people sick than it heals. And this quote was fresh in my mind after arguing with this guy, because arguing that English guy, arguing the details with him was completely worthless, because if he didn't like accept the foundation that medical intervention was a long history of unscientific practices, like we would never get anywhere with talking about the details of anything. And so that, and again, all your work exemplifies that is the big problem, that these people have maybe they do know what they're doing, but they're doing things in harmful ways to hurt people.
I've done some newsletters talking about the events in American medicine in particular, starting around 1850, when the American Medical Association decided to take over the world. They really were a very hostile group that wanted to racially, they saw herbalists and other theories of healing, they saw them as as inferior people. Native Americans had some very effective techniques, but they connected it to racism. Black people were excluded, and practical medicine, a lot of it that had been brought from Africa, that was excluded. And what was left was what has been called allopathic medicine, the use of a single chemical to treat a single defined disease. And so it created an essentialist rather than an environmentalist approach to disease. The treatment of it became a very controllable one remedy for one disease, and only the doctors were qualified to name the disease and therefore to prescribe the one specific chemical that would treat it. A totally fraudulent anti-scientific view from the ground up.
And the cures are worse than the disease, the burn, cut, poison, the strategies.
And all that comes from the same essentialist thing, that cancer is essentially not human material. And all that can be done, because it has essentially changed its nature, is to kill it. So the whole concept is to kill it, not to heal the person who happens to be producing that tumor.
Sorry, go ahead. Just to refresh my memory, the essentialism, that's like a immutable traits that can't change. Is that what that is?
A gene is immortal. That our properties, our qualities are immortal, and they consist of the immortal genes, something absolutely separate from our somatic selves. The germline, they created an imaginary embryological history of developing the gonads. They claimed to see something that can't be seen under the microscope, and until about the year 2000, biologists just absolutely had complete faith in that cluster of assertions about immutability of traits, the Gregor Mendel theory of inheritance, which was essentially designed to counter Darwin and Lamarck and evolutionary thinking. Nothing evolves if you have eternal parts that are constantly coming back in different proportions.
Thank you for that. We won't keep you too much longer, Ray. So just to do some Q&As, and Georgie, interrupt at any time. Okay, so our first question here is, can you ask Ray what is an electron? What do they look like? What are they made of?
That's something that a good chemistry professor or biologist might actually consider. But the physics establishment insists that it's a matter of a verbal set of definitions, and they won't tolerate such questions as how do we imagine in a realistic way what is an electron and what is it doing and how does it do it, and what does resonance mean? They say resonance is a matter between an electron and the nucleus, and the if you absorb energy from the environment or give it back, it's a matter of changing the relation between the electron and the nucleus. They don't want to have any images of how the wave front of an electromagnetic field approaching the nucleus and the electron, what happens at that interaction. It's sort of an all or nothing. You have to accept their definition and not think very much about it, because when you think about it and actually do experiments, you violate their essential definitions. For example, a German researcher, Helmut Schultz, I think his name was, put a laser beam horizontally through a thin crystal, inserted in the electron beam of an electron microscope, and an inert, I think, aluminum oxide field for the electrons to hit. No film or phosphor, so the electrons hitting the field shouldn't have done anything visible, but the color of laser going perpendicularly through the crystal added a resonant frequency to supposedly a beam of pure electrons, and an electron supposedly resonates only with reference to its nucleus, but the beam coming through the crystal in this experiment broke up into blue spots on the inert target area, showing that the laser energy was being absorbed by the electron itself, not an atom electron system, but the electron itself hitting a target somehow released the energy that it had resonated with. That has been repeated. The experiment has been done different times, and it represents something true about reality, but it totally undermines the whole official physics doctrine about what an electron is.
So is an electron essentially a standing wave in the neutrino sea?
Yeah, it's whatever that means.
it's a wave. It's a wave object, if you can call it that. It's not a point like particle, which is what they call it to be.
And the neutrino sea itself is
waves.
hard to visualize.
Great stuff. Thank you for that. Okay, can you ask him if he has heard of Walter Kilner, and if so, what he thinks about his use of dicyanin to observe the human aura?
I hadn't heard of it.
Oh, can you comment on the aura? Is that just extension of like field theory or these bioelectric fields around us?
I suspect that people are actually seeing that field. At the time, I was having my very intense electrical fields, a psychic that I didn't know but was visiting a roommate, told my roommate that I had a very weird aura. And, when she went through the room, she seemed to be cringing, like she was avoiding heat coming off me or something.
That's what Aphrodite noticed. That's why you guys had such a good connection.
Yeah.
What, but could it be a projection of the hologram that the brain creates of reality as a model inside the organism? So it just extends just a little bit outside of the body.
Yeah. I think other organisms can tune in and get the picture.
Okay. What does Ray see in his mind when he thinks of the cell?
A series of things, cells that I have seen.
Like those new elaborate kind of digital images where they're all like looks like something, somebody threw something against the wall and it's kind of like a spatter thing. Is that the image that you have?
No, I think of them as little personalities.
How do you explain the discrepancy, but of thinking of there are like these round things and then those new photos of them being kind of these scatter things, or are both of those incorrect interpretations?
Each cell has its field, and Ortega Gasset said of a person that I am I and my circumstance. The cell is in the same situation as a person itself, and its circumstance are identical. So as soon as the circumstance changes, the cell is no longer what it was.
Appreciate that, Georgie. Interrupt anytime. Can Dr. Pete elaborate on a bioenergetic view of sex determination during embryonic development? Would the mother's hormonal environment play a big role in the process?
Temperature hormones, stress hormones in particular, in fish and reptiles and birds even, the temperature is very essential to developing the sex ratio.
It entirely depends on temperature, right? Like alligators, when they lay eggs, if it's hot, it's mostly males that they get catch?
Yeah, and chickens, the same thing. Early in the season, I forget which way it is, but it's a balance that's beneficial to have lots of females relative to males when conditions are going to be optimal.
Do you think the high ratio of females to males, do you think that's nature's essentially protective mechanism to the species? I mean, protecting the species from disappearing if the environment is not good, it's better to have more females than males because one male can essentially ensure the continuation. But if you have equal amount or more males, it becomes more difficult to reproduce.
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting. Okay, another one here.
As an extension, the recent statistics that we're seeing all over the world that a lot more girls are being born, aside from endocrine disruptors that are known to be estrogenic and that can cause it, could it also be a sign that the conditions are deteriorating in our environment and the human race basically is producing more women in order to have a higher chance of survival?
That sounds very reasonable.
You just reminded me of something. What that IQ drop of kids that were born in 2020, is this going to result in a profoundly stupid society in the next 10, 20 years?
There was have you read Ernest Sternglass's books or articles? He studied the effects of radiation on miscarriages and the ratio of boys surviving and so on. And he shows that at the peak atmospheric contamination from the 1963 bomb competition, that atmospheric testing of nuclear bombs, 18 years later, academic scores of all sorts, what's the standard exam that
SAT.
High school? The average score went down, and the genetic people said that's because more poor people are taking the test. But he showed very clearly that the looking at just the highest scoring portion of the population, that the greatest decrease 18 years after the radiation peak, the greatest decrease was in the highest scoring category. So it lowered the average, but it even more drastically knocked out the exceptionally competent kids of that age.
You've read about they call it the Flynn effect, right? The rising IQ scores throughout most of the 20th century, then in the 90s they plateaued, and after 2000 they've been steadily dropping.
Even though some countries show lately that the ratio of the brain to the body weight and height has decreased in several countries.
And that's not even
were these developed countries
Germany was one of them.
Oh, wow.
Not even accounting for the indefinite mRNA vaccines these kids are going to have to deal with. Okay, here's another one. Are Sheldrake's morphic fields and Vernadsky's noosphere the same thing?
They could be. general optimistic view of reality is connecting them and behind them, that the universe itself is conscious in some intentional way, that Vernadsky said in the midst of the ending of the Second World War, he was surrounded by destruction and death, but he said he was confident that the world would find a way out of it by increasing its metabolic rate, accumulating carbon dioxide, warming things up, making brains get bigger, making plants grow faster, everything working more intensely. And the noosphere idea is the basic thing that we're all headed in that direction, just because of the nature of the universe.
Did Russian science incorporate like Vernadsky's geocosmic realism into their thinking?
A large part of the establishment did.
Do you think he's... go ahead.
There were the dogmatic... I think of them as the Hegelian Marxists, the ones that thought the dialectic was some mysterious thing, but the average intelligent, well-read Russian biologist and scientist in general had that sort of an emergence orientation that it's part of the Marxist meaning of the dialectic, but it goes with an optimistic view of what the cosmos is all about.
Amazing. Thank you for that. Give me a second here. Okay. Ray has previously mentioned how our ruling class damaged art in the 20th century and highlighted the creation of Rockefeller ghost art. If a counterculture painting movement was to start today, what themes, styles, or subjects would Ray like to see captured or communicated? Many thanks from Australia.
I think a little bit of the realism of Franz Hals, the perceiving interesting things in people. Anything that is a worthwhile insight about the nature of people and their interactions. Franz Hals was a very confident at capturing such things.
Yeah, what? But did you mention him in Generative Energy in 1994? You said that. What do you like? It's like more alive, his paintings. They were not just like a static, boring view of the person, or they reflected something about their personality.
He could perceive intensely enough that he could capture instantaneous things that represented much more of the person than a photograph would have.
Yeah, his paintings are, you can easily see that when you're looking at his paintings. Okay. We'll wrap it up here very soon. Okay. Does Ray think starch is responsible for a change in personality towards war and conquer that has caused the atrocities since the beginning of agriculture?
Well, it goes with malnutrition. The high starch diets end up tending to be deficient in some of the essential nutrients, high phosphate, stress-inducing things that make people irritable and authoritarian, high serotonin outcome of the inflammatory diet.
Great stuff. And Georgie, interrupt me at any point here. Just a few more here. Okay. What is the cost of getting drunk occasionally, like blackout, passed out in the front yard, naked, drunk, like five times a year, not financially, but like on your health and longevity?
I think it's very stressful to lose your consciousness.
Maybe you told somebody an email a long time ago that it like greatly depletes your liver glycogen and it would take multiple days to recover. That's my experience. Like drinking is never worth it because I'll feel so awful the next few days. And so it just affects some people more than others based on their ability to store liver glycogen, do you think?
Yeah, I think so.
Wouldn't taking a hefty dose of progesterone largely replicate the effects of getting drunk?
It increases your ability to store glycogen, so it doesn't have any long-term negative effects. But when I accidentally overdosed on it, I noticed that coordination of my hands and feet was impossible for a while. But when I deliberately took a very large amount, because I had a bad migraine, I went with the euphoria, simply went to sleep in about 2 minutes and had no more headache. But when it comes on accidentally and you are where you should be able to use your hands and feet, it's embarrassing.
Okay, let me just do one more advertisement, then we'll close out the show here. Okay, so you can purchase Ray's newsletter for $30 for 12 issues over 3 years, four times a year. You can purchase his book at books at Ray Peets by emailing raypeetsnewsletter@gmail.com. From PMS to menopause, progesterone and orthomolecular medicine, generative energy, mind and tissue, nutrition for women. And then if you want to purchase progesterone, progesterone, specifically from Kenogen, email Catherine@kenogen@gmail.com. Each bottle contains 3,400 milligrams of progesterone. And then, Ray, again, people hate when I ask you to speculate, but what do you think we're in store for in 2022?
I think resistors are going to put up more and more resistance, but Bill Gates has already said that people are working on a vaccine for the Marburg hemorrhagic fever virus, which is similar to the Ebola virus and kills up to 90% of the people it infects. And he says that is likely to be the next epidemic. And since they are about ready to have a vaccine for it. I think he might be right. As soon as a vaccine is able to come to market at a profit of $500 billion, then we can have the Marburg epidemic. But I think the resistance is gaining faster than the clever World Economic Forum schemers can dream up catastrophes to happen to us.
But if this Warburg virus, if it's so deadly, just like Ebola, then it can't really be a pandemic because it's going to kill most of the hosts before it has a chance to spread, right? How would you have a pandemic with that?
It's just scarier, and that's all that's needed is to have a vaccine that is going to save everyone, and all it has to do is kill a few dozen people that they didn't want anyway, and then they can sell $1 trillion worth of vaccines.
It'd probably be much more easy to mandate because they'll be, look, this is truly deadly. Don't resist because COVID is nothing compared to this.
Yeah.
But you're saying they could actually release something harmful, not like COVID being a mild type of thing, but this actually being harmful?
Since so many people have caught on that don't want the vaccine and realize that the vaccine mortality goes up the first month after being vaccinated higher than not receiving the vaccine, that awareness is getting out. And so they need something really to scare people, show people bleeding out of their eyes and ears, and a real horror show.
Wow. Yeah, that would do it. And so this second act, you think it was strategic in making it even more gruesome?
I think that's why they're interested in it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, well, we have that look forward to in 2020. Very, very excited about that.
Can't wait.
Okay, Ray, stay on the line. Guys, thank you so much for hanging out. Sincerely appreciate it. This year, other than being a total horror show, I've had fun doing this podcast. And Georgie and Ray, you guys always make it really special. And these have been my anchor this year of doing these. And I sincerely appreciate all the viewership. And you guys are just a great, great audience. And you guys always give positive feedback. And so sincerely appreciate it. So Georgie Dienkopf, thank you so much. And Ray, thank you so much. Just it's been really incredible. And I can't wait to continue to do it in 2022. So Ray, stay on the line. And guys, have a safe weekend. We'll talk to you guys soon. And have a good New Year's. And peace out. Bye, everyone.